From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. Anne Curzan might seem like a strange sort of English teacher. The veteran professor doesn't believe in right and wrong when it comes to language and grammar. Rather, she wants people to be able to make informed choices about language, to become caretakers of language rather than gatekeepers for it. But here's the challenge. In order to be informed about what rules to break, it sure is helpful to know what the rules are. And more than that, it's important to know how these rules came about, because there really isn't such a thing as right and wrong when it comes to this evolving part of who we are. Anne Curzan is a professor of English linguistics and education at the University of Michigan. She's also the host of a weekly segment on Michigan Public Radio called That's What They Say, which explores our changing language. And she is the author of a new book called Says Who, a kinder, funner usage guide for everyone who cares about words. Anne Curzan, I'm stoked to have you. Literally, ain't no topic off limits here. So let's vibe, irregardless of what others might think. Word?
Wow, that is a great introduction. I'm delighted to be here.
Hey, Anne, humans are always adding words to their languages. So I thought we should start today by introducing people to two words that they might not know, but which I think are pretty obvious when you first hear them. Let's start with gramando. What's a gramando?
I love this word. This word was introduced in the New York Times Magazine by Lizzie Skernick in the segment That Should Be a Word. And I completely agree with her that this should be a word. So I'm working hard to make sure it is. She defines a gramando as someone who constantly corrects other people's language. And the example she gives is a wife correcting her husband for using the word irregardless.
Which is such a great word. Come on. I mean, I know it's not a word, but it is a word because we use it.
That's exactly right. It is a word. And when people say to me, it's not a word, I find that fascinating in terms of unpacking what do they mean when they say it's not a word. Sometimes what they mean is it's not in a dictionary, or at least I don't think it's in a dictionary. Irregardless is, however, in most dictionaries. It may be labeled non-standard in a dictionary, but it's there because, as you note, it is a word. We know what it means. It means regardless. And for some speakers, irregardless is actually emphatic.
Yeah, I think that's the context in which I hear it. So gramandos are the kinds of people who would say that is not a weird word. Irregardless is not a word. Or as I heard from many of my teachers growing up, ain't a word. But which also, actually, we should say, at least if they're asking what's in the dictionary, that thing's been in there for a very long time.
And here's one of the things I want to make sure to say, though, is that we can talk about people who are gramandos, but each one of us has a little or a slightly bigger gramando in our head. And it's what I call our inner gramando. And I'm a linguist. I love studying language change. I take a very descriptive approach to language. I'm excited to hear what's happening out there in the world. And I still have a little gramando in my head who hears some language changes and thinks, seriously? Does the language have to change that way?
Is that voice the voice of your mother? Because your mom was a gramando, right?
My mom was a gramando. I grew up with a very prescriptive mother. She was trained as an editor. She edited my papers when I was in junior high school and high school. But she had very strong ideas about what was right and wrong in language, including when we went to the grocery store, if there was a sign that said 10 items or less, she would point out that this sign was wrong and it should
say
fewer.
Your mom is my patron saint. That's mine. That's my pet peeve.
On this one, I'm afraid that you may lose. And what's interesting with less and fewer is that this rule actually, from what we can tell, started as a preference. In the 18th century, we have evidence that a grammarian wrote in his grammar book that he thought it was more elegant if fewer was used for countable nouns and less was used for uncountable nouns. And then by the time we get to the early 20th century, this has become a rule about what is right. But what's interesting to me is that less is used with countable nouns in some very idiomatic ways, so that even you, who likes this rule, may say it sounds better, for example, to say, write an essay of 500 words or less.
Ooh, I think I do that. I think I do that without even thinking about it.
Right. And words, clearly, because we're saying they're 500 or less, they're countable.
So can you tell me the story about your mom and your sister's wedding?
I can. This is a bit of family lore. It's true. My older sister was getting married and my younger sister was giving a toast at the rehearsal dinner. And she at one point said, "For my husband and I," and my mother from the back of the room pipes up, "And me," in the middle of a wedding toast.
Did everybody die?
Oh, it was so funny. And I love telling that story because I want people to know that I grew up in this very prescriptive environment. It wasn't until I went to college and I discovered linguistics that I knew there was another way to think about language. And what I'm now trying to do is help people see that there is what to me is a more fun, more linguistically informed, more inclusive way to think about grammar and language that actually can make you an even better speaker and writer, because you're not constrained by this strict sense that there's only one right way and everything else is wrong. Instead, you can think about lots of effective ways to use language depending on context and audience. And what I love about this approach is that it lets us be kinder to each other. And that, I think, is really a wonderful thing, because there is a lot of gatekeeping that happens around language.
Yeah, you've written that grammandos can make us feel very self-conscious of the language that we use. And in fact, you've written that because people often remark upon your word usage, even you are self-conscious sometimes, for instance, when you're writing emails.
Oh, it's a sport. It is a sport, which is, given what I do, can you find things in an email that I send that you think are quote unquote wrong? And if you can, then you send them to me to tell me that I am wrong. I also feel badly that there are people who say, "I'm always really nervous to write to you, Anne, because I feel like I have to be so careful with my grammar and I might make a mistake." And I always say to them, "I am the last person you need to worry about, because I'm interested in language change. I'm interested in all the variety." But I would also point out that people correct each other's written language on a regular basis. You see it happen, for example, in sports comment sections on blogs and other places. I tend to read those. And you'll see a heated debate about a basketball game or something like that. And then as people get really angry, someone will use an apostrophe in an untraditional way. And someone will say, "You're just wrong. And you don't even know how to use an apostrophe."
As if that has anything to do with your ability to make an assessment of something that happened on a sports court.
That's right. But it is a very powerful move to call out the way someone is speaking or writing. And it's one of the important points in the book, is that power, that when you stop someone and correct them or say they've done something wrong, it's very silencing. And I think many of us can remember a moment or many moments when someone's done that to us. And it makes you realize that they're listening to the way you're talking as much or more than to what you're saying. And that can make you very self-conscious about saying anything and want to stop talking or talk less. So one of my messages is that we should be very careful about how we use that power. It's not that you can never point out to someone, you know, there's another way to pronounce that word, or there's another place to put that apostrophe. But to do that publicly in front of other people might not be the best or kindest way to do that.
This sort of gets me to the other term I wanted to talk to you about today, which is wordy. This is a much more positive spin on someone who is very interested in language. You said that wordies are kind of like bird watchers. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So a wordy, which is a relatively new word, you'll now find it in dictionaries like Merriam-Webster online, defined as a lover of words. And here again, I would say we all have an inner wordy. We like language. We enjoy language. I would guess many listeners play Wordle or Spelling Bee or Boggle or Scrabble. We like to pun. We like to rhyme. We're also often very curious about language. So when people, for example, learn that I know why kernel is spelled with an L and pronounced with an R, they typically get very excited about that in terms of, oh, I've always wondered about that. So this wordy in our head is really curious about language. And part of the book is talking about how we should and can think about talking with both our inner wordy and our inner grammando as part of being effective users of language. And I came up with this analogy that the wordy can be thought of as the bird watcher of language. So as you're moving through the world, you'll hear or see language that's unfamiliar to you, or hear a new usage and think, huh, that's new. And that's where I would say, think like a bird watcher, which is be curious about that new usage bird, listen to it, look at it, be curious about where it came from, how it works, as opposed to trying to kill it, which would be a very strange thing for a bird watcher to do. A new bird, let me see if I can kill it. But often with language, we hear a new bit of language and that can be our first response is, ugh, it's new, I don't like it.
Well, and bird watchers used to do that, and that's how we wound up with a lot fewer birds to watch.
And I admit it can happen to me. A recent example is the verb double click, which I heard from a colleague of mine here in the business school, and he uses double click as a way to transition between slides, and it means to dig deeper into something. So he would have, for example, a slide with three factors on it, and then he would say, okay, let's double click on the first one, and that would take us to the next slide. And I was sitting in a presentation where he was double clicking and double clicking, and I thought, oh, this is such business jargon. I don't like it. This is ridiculous. And I came home and I told my partner, I had to sit through this presentation with all this double clicking. And he looks at me and he says, I think that's actually quite clever. And as soon as he said it, I thought, of course it is. It's playful. It's actually a great metaphorical use. Why am I being so cranky about it?
He was being the wordy in that situation and you were being the grammando in that
situation. I had let my inner grammando speak and his inner wordy corrected my inner grammando.
You know, I've found myself doing this sometimes. One of the shifts that I have noted is this difference between, or substitution, I should say, of try and. I'm going to try and do something instead of I'm going to try to do something. And it's, you know, ubiquitous enough now that I see it in, you know, what we would term proper writing enough now that I don't intend to correct my students when I see them use try and. But I often remark on it. They'll say something, oh, I'm going to try and do this. And I say, oh, you're a triander, which I love. I love the term triander, but it's really confusing to them. And you're right. It derails what we're doing, even though I'm not being critical. I'm just being observant. But I think from their standpoint, it doesn't matter. They're sort of thrown off by it.
And I want to point out that try-and may actually be older than try-to.
Ooh, tell me more.
Ooh. It's a pretty old construction. And you are not alone in having concerns about it. But there are other constructions where we have verb and verb that people don't have as strong a reaction to, such as come and get it. Mm-hmm. So we get come and verb, and people don't feel concerned about that, but we get try and verb. And I think people think somehow that is sloppy, a sloppy change over time, that it was to, and then we slurred the to and it became and. But in fact, the try and construction is really old.
And this is also what you've pointed out about the singular they, which a lot of people are having a really hard time with right now, but is not a new thing at all.
I have actually dedicated quite a lot of my career to studying the pronoun they, for better or worse. And we have evidence of singular they back to at least the 13 and 1400s, where they is being used to refer to a person of unknown, unspecified, irrelevant gender. And in fact, we almost all do this and have been doing it for hundreds of years. Even people who don't like singular they often use singular they. An example construction would be something like, someone who knows where they're going should give us directions. Someone, clearly one person, someone who knows where they're going. So that they is singular. Or a teacher should learn their students' names. A teacher, there. That construction is very old. We actually also can trace when we were told it was wrong. It goes back to the 18th century, where we start to get grammar books that say the masculine can encompass everyone, so you can just use he. And in fact, this very famous grammar book called The English Grammar by Lindley Murray, he has a sentence where he actually crosses out a singular they and puts he. And for almost 200 years, we had this rule that you had to use singular he as a generic in order to be correct. And then second wave feminism pushed against that starting in the 1970s to say, this is a sexist construction to use he that way. At which point we got he or she, or use he in one paragraph and she in another paragraph, which is confusing. Or rewrite the whole thing so you don't need a pronoun, which sometimes works, but sometimes you just need a pronoun. It's also not inclusive, because there are people who don't identify as either he or she. And so the question we should all be asking is, why can't we just use they? And sometimes people will say to me, well, because they cannot be singular. To which my answer is, but it is. And they say, but it can't be. And I say, but it is. So the question is, why can't we write it down? And that's where we get to these prescriptive grammar guides that have said, it's too informal, it's too confusing, it's ambiguous. And it's fair to say there are contexts where they can be ambiguous, but that is true of any pronoun.
Something that I've noticed when my kid was about junior high school age is that they used they to describe pretty much everyone around them. For me, like, he or she is the default. And unless somebody tells me, hey, I prefer they, that's the default. But for my kid, they was the default, presumably until someone expressed a desire to be a he or a she. I find this sort of use of a word quite fascinating, because it's not just a use of a word that is unfamiliar, but it's representative of a shift in mindset in general related to the use of a word.
And I love your inner wordy speaking there of, I find this fascinating, is what you said, which I think is exactly right, that we're watching some cultural shifts here in terms of gender and gender norms and how younger people are experiencing this and talking about it. And it is a really interesting thing to watch. And what I also see, like you're seeing, is that for younger people, if they're growing up in communities where they're interacting with a lot of other younger people who may identify as they, it is part of their grammar. And they look at some of us who are older and they will say, I don't see why this is so hard for you to use they as a singular. So let's talk about where the rule comes from, whether you can or can't do it, when you might encounter people who might be cranky about it, what you're going to do about that. That's being a savvy writer and speaker, is being aware of the rules, being aware of where they come from, whether they correspond with usage, and then getting to make informed decisions without just thinking, is this right or is this wrong? You get to think, what do I want to do for this audience as a speaker or writer?
You know, I really like that you have space and understanding for people who use language in new and non-standard ways, but also for people who grew up in a world of rules. Because, look, humans evolved as a tribal species, and tribes have rules. We're really hardwired to adopt a rule, embrace a rule, allow that to become part of us, and allow that to communicate to other people about belonging. And so when somebody comes along and says, well, I got a different way of doing it, and that violates a rule, it's really bucking against one of the things that allowed us to become who we are today.
And I think it's important to acknowledge that there are some pieces of more prescriptive guidance about language, particularly written language, that can be useful. They're designed to minimize ambiguity, for example. And one of the hard things about writing, and I wish someone had said this to me when I was an emerging writer in junior high school, high school, is that A, writing is hard. It's not just spoken language written down. And part of what's hard is that you won't be there when your audience is reading this. And it means that you need to be much more specific and clear and unambiguous than we get to be when we speak. We can tolerate quite a lot of ambiguity in conversation because we have context. We can look confused if someone says something ambiguous and the person will clarify. But as writers, it is very helpful to minimize ambiguity. And this is why dangling or misplacing a participle in speech, we don't even notice. And often in writing, we don't notice, but sometimes it might actually convey the wrong thing. So it's worth looking at and making sure that you haven't conveyed something that you didn't mean to.
And sometimes these things that we might call errors, they're not errors. And the way that you're thinking about it, they're just different ways of using language. But a lot of other people have been programmed to believe that they are wrong. And so, as you say, you won't be there when your audience is reading this. And when they are reading this, they might get stuck on that thing and stop reading what you're writing. Stop being carried away by the literary qualities of what you're writing and just be distracted, even just for a moment, by what they have been told is a broken rule. And all of a sudden, you've lost them as a writer.
This is such an important point, and it's a reason I wrote this book, is that I think we need to think about, in the written context, both the writers and the readers. And often we will put all of the burden on the writer and say, you just have to follow those rules because your readers are going to expect that. But my book is also aimed at the readers. For all of us who have the power to be gatekeepers, to look at language again with our inner wordy hat on, to be more tolerant of variation, to be curious about the new, so that we're not saying, I saw this in a job letter, I think it's new, and you don't get this job because I don't like that bit of usage. To lower the gates, allow for more diversity and more change in language. So it's not just that the writers have to follow these rules, but that we as readers could realize that many of those rules are actually not particularly well-founded, and it's okay if people aren't following them.
That's Anne Krizan. She's a professor of English linguistics and education at the University of Michigan and the author of a new book, Says Who, A Kinder, Funner Usage Guide for Everyone Who Cares About Words. Anne Krizan, thank you.
Oh, this was such fun.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us, then you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Science at Utah State University and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.